From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made at or near the top of a list. Over the last several years, the Rochester housing market has been one of the hottest in the country, repeatedly ranking first or in the very top tier of the nation's markets where housing supply is low and demand is high. We continue to hear stories about buyers waiving inspections, paying way over the asking price, or paying in cash. Our team was talking with a prospective buyer a week ago who has been putting in offers for more than a year and continues to be outbid, the latest outbid by more than $100,000. The local hot housing market is a story in itself, but it also has broad effects on the community and the economic landscape. Whether you're already a homeowner or you're looking to buy, the market can affect you. We've had conversations on this program about the recent property reassessments in the city of Rochester. According to reporting by our WXXI colleague, Gino Finelli, many city homeowners had a little bit of sticker shock when they saw their new assessments. Across Rochester, preliminary residential property assessments rose an average of about 68%, adding more than $3 billion to the city's tax base. In fact, none of the 132 neighborhoods assessed by the city saw a decrease in assessed single-family home values. But I should say, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're paying more. The city's property tax rate went down, and it could be a little bit of a complicated puzzle if you're not used to the math, but there's been a lot of talk about how that affects people. All of these issues intersect, and this hour we'll be spending some time to understand them. Economist Kent Gardner recently wrote about the effects. We discuss how the last 5 years or so have affected the current local economic landscape with our guest, Kent Gardner, the former chief economist at the Center for Governmental Research. You find his work in the Rochester Beacon, among other places. Welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan. Nice to be here, as always.
Mark Seawick is a broker and owner of Elysian Homes by Mark Seawick and Associates. Elysian Homes.
Yes, sir.
Welcome.
Ooh. Good to see you.
I like that name. I like the idea of Elysian.
Thank you.
Yeah. And Mark is among the more experienced people in this entire line of work. So Mark can help us understand trends and what he and his team are seeing. Let me start with Kent. And I know this is part of a series. Why don't you tell listeners why you were writing about this now and what you hope that they could gain from it, Kent?
Yeah, the property assessment process is a great mystery to most homeowners. Frankly, the property tax itself is, I think, the least well understood tax we have in our in our tax portfolio. Sales tax, everybody kind of gets that, 8 cents on the dollar. All right, we grumble, we pull out our wallet, and we pay the tax. The income tax, frankly, is in many ways something we kind of understand. We understand what our income is. We look at the our W-2s. We take a look at our tax forms. We say, well, once again, we're grumbling. I don't want to pay this, but
you can kind of understand it. Yeah.
We understand,
yeah,
it, right?
Yeah.
The property tax is a mess. at least from a consumer's benefit. Now, I don't want to say that the property tax ought to be eliminated, as some people claim. I actually think it's a really good tax and it's a really important tax, but it is a very confusing tax. So let's first talk about why it's an important tax. In the United States, we tend to tax either income, income tax, or we tax consumption, what we buy with the income that we have. Now, what we don't tax in the United States very much is wealth. And so you have someone who, is maybe sitting on assets of $10 million, and except in those cases in which that money, the wealth actually earns income, it doesn't get taxed. So here's people who have a capacity to help support our local schools, the capacity to help support a lot of the things we do in society, but we have no way of getting at that income. And in terms of total well-being, people with millions of dollars in assets really deserve to be part of the piece. So that's where the property tax comes in. It's not a perfect instrument, but it is the only place where we consistently assess people who have lots of who own wealth and ask them to contribute a portion of that wealth to supporting our schools, to supporting our police, to supporting roads maintenance, all the things that we do with the property tax.
By the way, it took 90 seconds for us to get the first email with a question and comment from listeners who are struggling trying to buy, and Mark Seawick is ready for those questions. We'll have plenty of time for that. Listeners, if you want to email the program, it's connections@wxxi.org. You can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Kent, you tackled a couple of different prongs of this as well. And some of this is exactly why Mark Siebeck is here. We're going to talk about how the market is for buyers, how it is for sellers, but also this question of will my taxes go up? And one of the really interesting things about watching the reassessment in the city of Rochester has been this, I don't want to call this a snug bifurcation, but this really heated debate that happened this past winter into the spring, where it was like a 68% average upward reassessment. Some people were celebrating, saying, hey, that's a lot of new possible wealth and value, et cetera. Others were saying, well, I'm not going to be able to afford my taxes. A lot of people immediately assumed that meant they were paying 68% more in taxes, which was not correct. And the even on Rochester City Council, you had 4 out of the 9, so not a majority block, but 4 members of council trying to stop the reassessment, saying it was potentially unfair, that it was going to hurt people, and that it should stop or pause for now. I'm really sure what the plan was. Pause it, I guess. So I want you to take me through a little bit of how you see it. I'm going to work backwards here. First of all, what did you make of 4 members of Rochester City Council saying, pause the assessment, no new reassessments?
Well, the only reason you do an assessment is to make sure that people are paying their fair share of taxes, and the people who have seen greater appreciation than the others, if their property value has gone up more, that they're going to pick up a bigger share of that. But so it really is about equity. So if you're opposed to the reassessment, that means you want to leave inequities in place. The whole point of the reassessment is to make the tax system more fair. So if you're opposed to making the tax system more fair, go ahead and campaign on that. But that is not something I would support.
Okay. Now, I think they would say, no. See, we've tried to encourage more people to own homes, and that's a good thing overall. But when they get the sticker shock of this upward reassessment and their tax bill suddenly jumps, then perhaps they can't afford to stay in a home that they previously could afford, and that is not fair. What do you think?
Well, you tackle two pieces there. First, the question is, the assumption there is that if you're renting, you're not paying property taxes. Well that's absolutely not true. I can go into there's a depth of literature in economics where we try to determine who really bears the burden of the property tax. And it's very clear in a place like Rochester that if you're a renter, trust me, you're paying part of the property tax. So let's put that aside. But the second thing we need to do is to understand how the property tax works. You pay the property tax according to your share of the total property value. And it is not – so let's just disassemble this for a little bit. Suppose we've got 100 homes in a community, each of which is worth $100,000. Everyone pays, and then the tax levy is set by the mayor and by the city council. The tax levy is the amount of money that gets raised. The tax rate gets determined by taking the tax levy and dividing it by all the assessed value. So the tax rate is determined. The tax rate determines how what share of your property value gets put into the common coffers. But the point here is that your share of the tax levy is your share of the total assessed value. So if you own a lot of property value, then you're going to pay a larger share. But it doesn't. The assessed value does not change the tax levy. That's a completely separate decision made by the mayor and city council. And to their credit this last year, despite the fact that the assessment was going on and despite the fact that it was clear that assessed values were rising, so the total assessed value in the city went up, as you suggest, 68%, and yet they left the tax levy the same. So the consequence of that was not that tax rates didn't go up. Tax rates went down, and they went down by a lot. And that was to reflect the fact that the tax levy had stayed the same, except the total value of assessed property had gone up.
Okay. And I guess I'm compelled to ask you if you think that was a wise decision.
Well, the question – let's go back to why you do a reassessment. I think we all know that the property values change over time. They change partly because people make improvements, and they change partly because some neighborhoods – get into vogue. They see values that are increasing more rapidly than other neighborhoods. Other neighborhoods are going hard times and the property values decline. And that kind of happens every single year. What the reassessment does is it looks at all those property values and says, well, you know, Evan's property is really worth a lot more because he's been in a hot neighborhood. And we should really reflect that and increase his assessment. On the other hand, boy, Mark, I mean, what an investor he is. He's in a neighborhood where the values are plummeting. And so he's getting whacked.
Don't worry, Mark. This is hypothetical. Go ahead, Ken.
He's looking nervous over there. So if Mark's in a neighborhood where the values are going down, he really deserves to get a break in his taxes. Evan's in a neighborhood where values are going up. He should be paying more. But again, the total tax levy doesn't change. It's not a function of the total assessed value. That's just all it does is divide up the piece. So property taxes are a zero-sum game. You've got a total levy that's got to be collected. The only question about the assessed value is, what share you pay.
Okay. Tell me if the math is correct here. I'm going to try to simplify this.
Yeah.
And tell me as a student if I'm failing or passing. Let's say the levy is $10. We're going to collect $10 in taxes. And there are 10 homes in our city. And they are all deemed to be worth a dollar. Or they're all the same value. And so everyone is going to pay a dollar. Everyone is paying the same. But then 4 years later, we reassess. Now three of the homes are viewed as significantly less valuable. Three of the homes are viewed as a lot more valuable. Four of the homes have stayed the same. We're going to keep the levy the same, so we're still collecting $10. But now, three of the homes are going to pay 50 cents a piece in taxes. Three of the homes will pay $1.50 in taxes. The other four will pay $1, the same. The challenge, I think, for a city like Rochester is to say, if we're reassessing and a lot of the values are going up, we could also just say the levy goes up and collect more money, but they're choosing not to do that. That was a choice. So when the values go up, now we're in a situation where you got 10 homes, we're still going to collect $10 here, but a lot, you know, seven of the 10 homes are in a much more higher value place. All of a sudden, the math is a little harder for me, but the city's still collecting 10 bucks, right? They're still collecting the same.
That's right.
And that's what we're looking at here.
Yeah, and I hate doing these mathematical things in my head. I always mess them up on the fly.
My best there.
You did great. But if folks want to go to one of my two Rochester Beacon stories.
Even better.
On the property gonna
post
text.
Him. We're going to post them in our show notes. Kent's work for the Beacon. We're going to post in our show notes. You should read them, consume them, and share them. Before I turn to Mark, one more question on this then. What you are describing then, as ostensibly controversial as it has been this year, is a normal course of action for any municipality, right?
It's a normal reflection of how real estate markets change. They evolve and they change, and we have to remember that values don't always stay the same. And you know, each of us know that in the context of our own lives. So, you know, we know that. Just simple things about like improvements. You know, my neighbor, you know, put in a swimming pool. Wow, look at that cool swimming pool. Their house is now worth more. The value of their home went up. They're going to be able to recoup that when they sell it. Realistically, if my value stayed the same and their value went up, I would expect their tax to be higher than mine. And that's what reassessment does. And it's not just improvements, but again, it's a lot of neighborhood effects. Again, neighborhoods go in and out of vogue. Rochester has actually done quite well. I think as you mentioned at the beginning, Rochester values have been going up for a little while. And that's, again, a good thing. So that's one final thing I want to point out is that when the assessment goes up, it means that people have more equity in their home. You can use that equity. Perhaps you can borrow against that equity and build an addition onto your house. You can borrow against that equity and use it for college. You can sell your house and get more out of it when you sell. So more home equity is a good thing. The assessment office, when they did the reassessment, they concluded that the total assessed value of total assessed value, and we're adjusting it to 2024 dollars, went from $4.9 billion in 2023 to $7.9 billion after the reassessment. That's equity. That's value in people's pockets.
Kent, when was the last time the city actually reassessed?
2000.
2000. So, okay, so
it's 4 years.
4 years. So
2020.
2020.
So the statistic I always quote is
2020.
Every 4 years, 2020.
Yeah. So the system, or the metric that I've been quoting for the past, I don't know, 6 months, is that over the course of the past 4 years, there's been a 60% increase in the value of property here in Monroe County, and so the city raised by 68%. That makes sense to me, and we've got to pay for services. And back to the four members of city council, I think that their thinking is very, very short-sighted because they're concerned about people having to pay taxes today. Well, if they're not paying taxes and if we're not taking care of our parks and our roads and if we don't have a strong police force, then the value of the property is ultimately going to be falling with the passing of time because we are going to have an increasingly undesirable city in which to live.
And again, this improves the amount of wealth within, among families in the community. And you know, wealth allows you to do lots of things. I mean, we talk about how the inequities of wealth in our community. And thank goodness we've seen a situation where the wealth has actually increased. The other interesting thing out about this reval is that many of the lower valued neighborhoods that saw a greater increase in value than the higher valued neighborhoods in this reassessment.
So. Last point for Kent. Probably not. I don't want to lie. But on that subject of to take different neighborhoods, one of the common complaints, I guess, is that, not to use a term that is really seems to have an amorphous definition and is controversial, but if gentrification happens and we see a rapid increase in home values, and you've got families who maybe been there for decades, and all of a sudden it's not a 6% increase or a 10% increase, but they're seeing a 50% increase or more, and they're seeing a tax bill that they have not seen
before. A 50% increase in what, Evan?
Okay, fair.
Because their tax bill
the value of the property would not... A 50% increase in the value of a property. So if your home is $100,000 and now it's assessed at $150,000, your tax bill would actually go down.
It went down because the average went up by 60%.
By 68%.
Yeah.
Let's say it doubles, though. Let's say it is 100% increase in value, which is not impossible. I mean,
there are many neighborhoods where that did
that
occur.
Has happened.
That's right.
And
they end up paying a larger share.
So now you are paying higher taxes.
Right. Exactly.
And yes, all of a sudden your $90,000 house is worth $180,000, and you could sell it for that if you chose. But some people would say, "Look, I didn't choose that. I don't want to sell. I want to be here." But the tax bill is becoming a real burden for me, and you're forcing me out, and you're forcing wealthier people in. Is that gentrification?
Well, once again, I think we need to separate taxes, the reassessment from, if you're thinking as your property taxes is chasing you out, that is a different question. So, again, I'll say that because the tax levy stayed the same, the only thing that changed was the distribution of who paid and how much they paid.
Yeah.
Now, it's also true, however, that if the total value of properties goes up, for one thing, I talked about renters. If you are a renter in a neighborhood where the value of the property has gone up, you are going to pay more in rent. That's a function that can cause gentrification, absolutely. But that's a function of the market value of those houses going up. It's not a function of the tax system. The tax system is simply reflecting what the market has actually deemed. So gentrification is a very complex, difficult problem. It's a function of market values increasing. It doesn't have anything to do with the tax system.
And by the way, as I turn to Mark Seawick, let me just say again, thanks to Kent Gardner for these pieces in the Beacon. And I know that this stuff can feel opaque, but if you are in the city of Rochester proper and your house was assessed at $150,000 and it's now assessed at $225,000, your city tax bill is going down. Anything under 60% increase or so, you're actually going to pay a lower tax bill. So I know it can seem counterintuitive, but that's where we are. Let's start city proper, Mark Seawick. Mark is the broker and owner of Elysian Homes by Mark Seawick and Associates. City proper, how's the market? What does it look like to you these days?
It depends on the neighborhood that you're talking
about.
What
is hot?
As is always the case, you know, the question, I mean, I've been doing this for 32 years, and the question remains, or the answer remains the same. In the city of Rochester, Park Ave, East Ave, neighborhood of the Arts, all very, very, very hot.
What about North Winton?
North Winton Village, very hot. And it's funny you should actually mention North Winton Village. There's a commonality in that there are a lot of single-family homes in the neighborhoods that we're describing. Yes, Park Ave has a lot of rentals, but there are also a lot of owner-occupants there. And I think that's a commonality that exists amongst these neighborhoods that are hot.
South Wedge?
South Wedge, hot. Yeah. Yeah.
But can I point out, though, that despite the fact that those are hot neighborhoods, and they have been, those are not the neighborhoods where assessed values rose the most substantially in the reassessment. The neighborhoods that went up the most in the reassessment were Upper Falls and Market View Heights, mm-hmm. 14621. You know, 19th Ward, Jefferson, Genesee, Beechwood, Plymouth Exchange. Those values went up more than those hot neighborhoods that Mark mentioned.
And that probably has something to do with the fact that if you're thinking about a property that was assessed at $75,000, you know, $100,000 4 years ago, you know, it's if it's being raised to $150,000, that's a 50% increase. You know, that 50% increase on a prop. Or, I'm sorry, a $50,000 increase on a property valued 4 years ago for $400,000. It's not as large a percentage in
sure,
the market.
Sure, but,
yeah.
But really what we're looking at in Beechwood in market views, we're looking at homes that were assessed at 60 that are now 140, things
yeah,
like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, right.
Exactly,
yeah, yeah.
Or assessed at 40.
Assessed at 40 and are now 100,
and,
yeah.
You know, and so then the question of who benefits, who loses, depends on who actually is the owner of those properties. Mm-hmm. If you're the owner of a property that has gone up in value 200%, I mean, all those neighborhoods that I mentioned, are the property values either doubled or nearly doubled
yeah.
between those two, the 2020 and 2024 assessment period. So the owners of those properties did well. So that means if you're renting in those neighborhoods, then you probably are going to see an increase in your rent.
Right.
That's not good. On the other hand, if you're an owner, so I mean, back to the notion, you know, city council saying, you know, we've been urging people to buy, because it puts you in a better position. Well, they just cashed out. This proves the point that those council members have been making for a long time, that if you buy your home and you own your home, that you are in a position to gain more than simply renting.
Okay,
completely
now,
agree.
Now, Mark,
yes.
You've been doing this for how many years now?
32.
How is the housing supply now compared to any point?
There is none.
There's no supply.
Is
this the lowest point you've seen in your career?
Yes, and it's also historically the lowest it's ever been. So traditionally, this time of year, we should have 1,500 homes on the market for sale in the area. There are like 425 homes on the market for sale. There's nothing out there. Some statistics from earlier in the year, and I think you actually referenced some of this in your opening. We were the number one. Over the course of the past 4 years, 58% fewer homes available for sale in Monroe County today than there were 4 years ago. That's a dramatic drop off. We also were, as a result of that, the number one municipality in the country in terms of the number of multiple bids that we were securing when it is that a property would go on the market for sale.
Remarkable.
Remarkable. Number one. And as a result of that, we were the number one market in the country, the speed with which properties were selling. You know, 7 days on average.
Huge pressure on buyers.
Huge pressure. Yeah. Especially if you're a first-time buyer.
I mean, this is always one of the more stressful and pressure-filled situations anyone could be in. And now it's just ratcheted up because you know what the stats say. How much time do you have? How far above asking do you need to go? Do you have to pay cash? Do you waive an inspection? I mean, you don't have advantages as a buyer right now.
You have – it's slowly starting to change because there's slowly a little bit more inventory coming in the market for sale. Interest rates are starting to come down. But as it becomes easier – well, actually, there's another metric, which is affordability at historic lows. So as things are starting to change, that's terrific. But as interest rates come down and as more inventory comes on the market for sale, more and more buyers are going to enter the market. And so this is going to just continue for the next few years.
Ken?
So the great puzzle here is why we're different. Because the population has not been growing, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Population has been stagnant here for decades. You know, are we not building? We're not building new homes, but is that the rate of new home purchase building? Has that gone down, Mark?
I have met with builders, the Builders Association. I've met with Adam Bello, and there are too many impediments to building homes here in Monroe County. There's a lot of NIMBYism going on when it is that builders are presenting plans.
Worse than Long Island? Worse than the Lower Hudson Valley? Worse than Syracuse? Worse than Buffalo?
According to what these builders are saying, yes. anytime you go before a local town or village board, these proposals are being denied. And also, it's enormously, remarkably expensive to actually begin building. So... I think it costs, on average, somewhere in the neighborhood of $35,000 to $40,000 in improvements to a lot, even before you can start to begin building a house. So,
yes, so the great puzzle there is why is Rochester really different? I've heard those explanations for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. I don't know that they. I believe that they apply to most of New York State. You know, it's a real puzzle to me as to why we're suddenly in this position here in Rochester.
Whatever it is that's happening in other municipalities and other communities.
But not to this extent.
It remains the fact that we need to start building more homes. There needs to be some kind of governmental intervention, in particular on the lower end, for first-time home buyers. Go ahead.
Well, I'm the student in the class again.
Yeah.
Professor Seawick and Gardner here now with their various expertises. As the student, I feel like there's two possible explanations for why Rochester's region may be different, why we are still so hot as a housing market. Number one, we came into the last 5 to 8 years dramatically undervalued. And so maybe we are closer to an equilibrium.
Mm-hmm, yep.
Number two, and this is a very simplified thing that I hope Kent will chastise me for being too generalizing. But blue states build fewer houses than red states. Red states have more open policies on creation of new housing than blue states. Austin, Texas is a good example of a market that has built a lot, and they've actually arrested an exploding rate of value, to which, interesting, the population was saying, do something, and then they did something, and they went, well, where'd our values go? But it's Derek Thompson's written a lot about that.
Yeah, right.
But you can build more. So I am overgeneralizing here, Kent, but if it is very difficult to create new housing, even in a market that isn't seeing population growth, you need new housing. And if we're not doing it, then the demand, the supply is very low, the demand is very high, buyers are struggling, and everything looks hot.
Well,
how's that?
I think I agree with you, but, 75%, I mean, if there's always this complexity. And as it happens, I own a house in Austin, Texas.
Austin, Texas, of all places.
Well, it's, both of our children were in Austin. My son was in grad school, and my daughter was working as a social worker. And she actually just moved about a year ago. She now lives very close to you in Charlotte, Evan. But we still own the house, the three of us together. And so it's been interesting. So I've been going back and forth to Austin, partly because the house, I've been doing a lot of work on the house. So I've been down there 2 or 3 weeks a year since we bought the place in 2014. And every time you go to Austin, you see cranes. They're building. They have some of the other problems of boom towns, but they do let you build stuff. They also just passed an ordinance that will allow additional units on the same single-family lot. They haven't gone as far as California and banning single-family homes, but nonetheless, they've made it much easier for, you know, for us, for example, for the property we own. We could actually have do something on that lot and put some more put another housing unit in on that lot, and that's something we can do now that we couldn't do 2 years ago, and that's something we could do more of in New York State.
Do you see it as a Is it too generalizing to say red state, blue state trend lines and building allowance?
Well, you know, I think the generalization is generally true, but you know, if you take, that's what makes Austin such an interesting place. It's a, you know, it's a red state and a blue city. So for the blue city to pass those zoning ordinances relaxing the building code, but again, we saw that happen in Gavin Newsom's California. So I do think that the blue states and the blue cities are starting to realize that the problem, the way to fix the affordable housing problem is not to force people to put, to cut prices on the new homes that have just been built. If you don't reduce, add the supply by carving out 20% of the properties and saying, well, these are going to be cheap and the rest of them are going to have to pay the freight. That's not the way to fix the problem.
All right, I've got a lot of listener feedback here. Kent Gardner, former chief economist at the Center for Governmental Research, writing about these issues for the Rochester Beacon, and we are going to link to Kent's work on our show notes for when we post the audio for this page, wxxinews.org/connections, or wherever your podcasts are sold. Mark Sewick, broker and owner of Elysian Homes by Mark Sewick and Associates, also with us. Different Mark writes to say, Evan, we've been house hunting for over a year and are lifelong Rochester residents who have been renting. We've put in several offers over that time and none have been accepted. While looking for a house in the city, we've noticed a few things at open houses, such as out-of-state license plates. People are on FaceTime with out-of-state residents or younger people and their parents with retirement funds in hand to help purchase a house. We both make a good living. We've saved and are putting in relatively strong offers, but are finding it hard to compete with all those factors. My question is there any way for Rochester residents who want to stay in Rochester to compete in this housing market? That is from Mark, who writes to us. Mark Sewick, do you want to address that?
Yeah, sure. I know that there is this myth of the out-of-state buyers coming in, institutional buyers coming in. You know, there isn't a lot of institutional investing or purchasing that's going on. You know, there may be individuals from out of state, but I do think that if you're a Rochester resident and you want to purchase, you can do so, but you need to make sure that your offer is a strong offer. You need to make sure that you're all cash or you have an all cash equivalent. And if not, then you're not going to prevail. And if your mortgage broker is not providing that, then you need to find another bank. If your real estate agent is not introducing you to mortgage brokers, you probably need to find another real estate agent. There are means by which you can have an inspection conducted. One of the keys is most properties are listed for sale on a Thursday or a Friday. Make sure you're walking through within 24 hours of the property going on the market for sale. If you're walking through and you like it, then 24 hours after that, you ask the agent and the seller for permission to walk through with an engineer. Just a quick half hour, 45 minute cursory inspection so that when you do write an offer, which is usually due on a Monday, you're writing an offer that is free and clear of any encumbrance having to do with an engineer's inspection. Increasing the earnest money deposit is enormous. And then finding out or writing as strong an offer as you can. And that means usually writing an offer, $50,000, $75,000 over asking, $100,000 over asking. It's not happening as often or as frequently. Things are starting to change the past couple of months. But nevertheless, you need to be that competitive. We've heard over the course of the past few years, I'm not going to do that. I don't want to do that. And the reason I don't want to do that is because I don't want to overpay. Well, the people who were saying that 4 years ago have missed out on a 60% increase in the value of the real estate they could have purchased if they had just purchased 4 years ago. I don't see this market changing anytime dramatically in the near future. There's not going to be an enormous correction in terms of valuation. And I would suggest also, the agent that you're working with needs to be able to walk you through properties in advance of them coming on the market for sale or make you aware of properties before they're hitting the market. They also need to have a really, really strong relationship with their colleagues. And I know a lot of my colleagues who are listening probably don't want to hear this, but there are 35, 50 agents who really sell the bulk and the majority of the real estate that's out there. We all know each other. We all love doing work with each other because we know the job is going to get done. You know, perhaps you need to sit down with your agent and evaluate whether or not your agent is actually doing for you what it is that you need to have done.
Do you want to add anything there, Kent?
Yeah, I would. I mean, one of the things I'll say is that you know, what can't go on forever will end. And this market is nuts. Mm-hmm. It's dysfunctional.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime you've got a market where people are routinely expected to bid over asking, substantially over asking, you know, we know that the market is effectively broken. So this isn't going to last forever. One of the things that will help is we're going to see interest rates come down. We already see some movement in that direction. The Fed has been really good, I think, about sticking to its guns. They want to get inflation down. That's going to allow them to lower interest rates. So we are going to see interest rates come down. And when we do, we're going to get rid of this lock-in problem we have right now where, you know, I'm sitting on a house. I've got a $100,000 mortgage on my house, and I've got that mortgage at 3%. I can't replace my mortgage. with my 3% mortgage with another 3% mortgage, and so I'm going to hold fast. That's why there are so few homes on the market. It's not the whole reason, but it's an important piece of it. And when interest rates come down, we're going to see a floodgate, I think, of existing home buyers deciding that they want to trade up, trade down, trade out. And we'll see. See the market begin to stabilize.
And I agree with that. Nationally, 58%. There was a 58% increase in the number. 39% increase in the number of homes available for sale today versus same time last year. So the inventory is starting to increase nationally, and we'll start to see that happening here in Rochester after the first of the year, no doubt in my mind. However, as interest rates drop, the number of buyers who have been sitting on the sidelines is going to increase enormously.
And so even if our inventory, which is historically low, ticks up a little, the other factors could bring more buyers into the case. So it's still going to be really tough.
And we certainly still have to deal with the supply problem. There's no question about the winter.
Yes. And until we have more properties being built, and until there is governmental intervention on the local, on the county, on the state, on the national level, this is a problem that persists.
All right, John in Rochester on the phone next. Hello, John. Go ahead.
Hi, how y'all doing?
Very
Hi,
good.
Mark. Hi, Kent.
Hello.
Kent, thanks for all the great articles in the Beacon. Really appreciate that. My question for both of you has to do with the building of condominiums, given that the population is stable or shrinking slightly, depending on what numbers you're looking at. It seems to me that there's a shift in who is looking for homes. So the baby boomers may not be looking for single standing homes, but more condos. And the apartments that are available, whether it's mid-market, luxury market, you know, they're really at a price point where if you're not owning, that is a discomfort level for baby boomers. And there doesn't seem to be a lot of options to purchase condominiums in the city or near the city at a price point that would make sense. So you have the luxury ones or some real low-end ones scattered around in the suburbs sometimes. So I'd just like you to comment on the shift in population, the baby boomer population in the context of this market and the possible scarcity of diversified types of purchasing options. So not just single starter homes, but other kinds of options for owning and purchasing, not renting. So like what's being built on the Inner Loop or what might be built on the Inner Loop North and what's being built downtown, that's mostly apartments for rent.
Yeah, I completely agree. And condos are condos make a lot of sense of, you know, I'm a baby boomer. I mean, a lot of people are scaling down. I don't want to get rid of my workshop or I think about it. But people are wanting to go into multifamily buildings. I think older people want that, townhomes. But it is, you know, we've got some of the same barriers. Once again, you've got to go into debt. You've got to get a mortgage. If the mortgage rates are high, that's all going to make it more difficult. I must say, though, and I'm going to pitch this back to Mark, I am puzzled by why we don't see more condos. Downtown, for example, we've got some wonderful projects going on, multifamily projects, a lot of conversions. Almost all of them are rental. And that puzzles me. And also, I do know, too, that there's a lot of opposition to multifamily of any type in suburban Rochester.
Yeah, Rochester is never, if you think of the housing stock that exists in Monroe County, there aren't a lot of condominiums and townhouses. It's just never been particularly popular here. I have been saying for the past 25 years that the developers are going to have an opportunity as to create whether it is condominiums and townhouses or just more patio homes or ranches, anything having to do with first floor master bedrooms that is going to attract baby boomers. We've got an aging and a graying population. Go out and build more of these. And for some reason, both historically, that hasn't happened, and then for the reasons we've cited over the course of the past few minutes, that's not happening. But I also agree that downtown, I mean, how many office buildings are just sitting vacant? How many office buildings downtown have a 60% occupancy rate or a 30% occupancy rate? These properties are ripe for development. Take an elevator to your fifth floor apartment, and everything you need is all on one floor.
Yeah, there have been, and there have been some marvelous conversions already.
Yeah,
recently.
Yeah,
you know, think about the Metropolitan.
Andy. Daniel, Lina, thank God for Andy. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. Andy's been doing great work. Yep. I think the there really is more potential just because after, you know, post COVID we got a lot more office vacancy. But at the same time, there I just want to push this back to you, Mark. So is it the developers aren't building them, or that they build them and they don't get picked up? Developers, you know, do their homework and they say, well, these patio homes aren't going to sell. I'm not going to build them. What's the problem?
Patio homes have always hit a market. I think it's the condominiums and the townhouses. Condos and townhouses. Now we've got to bifurcate the conversation into pre and post COVID. Post COVID, anything with four walls and a roof is selling. You know, there's just no inventory. Pre COVID, for whatever reason, condominiums and townhouses just were never popular here in Rochester, and they would always take a little longer to sell. They would, and they wouldn't appreciate in value at the same rate that a single family home would. The reasons, I'm not quite sure, but, you know, one part of the country likes a particular type of barbecue. Another part, you know, likes, you know, a sweeter as opposed to,
interesting.
It's just a regional difference.
I'm a little concerned now. There's a mountain of email. I'm going to get through as much as I can.
Okay, so here we go. Rapid fire these.
A listener and Victor wanted to know, why are all the reports always focusing on Monroe County? I hope it's clear. We're talking about Rochester proper with the assessment. We're talking about the region generally, which isn't just Rochester. It's really not just Monroe County. I admit I don't know the dynamics of Interlaken, maybe Geneva, Penyan. I mean, I'm not as familiar, but I mean, I don't mean to be focusing just on the city of Rochester or even Monroe County.
And I've been focusing on Monroe County because, you know, that's where the preponderance of the data, you know,
that's where the data that we have.
And each of these markets is individual. You look at Geneva, that's a very different market. These are separate markets and a little hard to be, you know, an expert at all of them. So we just tend to work, as Mark says, where the data are.
It's not purposeful. It's just, you know, that's where the data lives.
Here we go here. Jim says, I don't think it's fair to pay property tax each year on an asset that I don't cash in. To my mind, that's a fancy tax that doesn't correspond to reality. I should be paying taxes one time only.
It says, you know, he's made misconception there is that taxes are only on income. And so he's saying, well, income, this is only a tax on income. Well, I'm sorry, buddy, it's a tax on wealth. It's because you have that asset and you could turn that asset into something else. It's just a different form of well-being. Would you rather take that that asset away? I mean, all of us benefit from having the assets that we can save and use in our retirement when we die and pass along to our kids.
Yeah, listen, I mean, I've got a lot of rental property that anyone in Park Ave East have. I am glad. Do I want to pay taxes? No. Do I have to? Yes. Am I glad to? Actually, I am. I don't send kids to the school district. I don't have any kids. But it's part of the social contract that exists between me and the rest of this community.
As you said, policing, fire, et cetera.
All of that. We've got to pay for these services somehow or another. So,
Emily in Rochester says, your guest made the argument that rising home value is universally good, and I don't see it that way. People who rent don't benefit from equity, and they only see their cost of living rise. Commodifying our basic needs of housing, food, and healthcare incentivizes capitalists to squeeze as much profit as possible from these needs, and the poor are bled dry. Kent?
Well, incentivizes capitalists to build houses and build apartment buildings. I mean, I'm afraid you can't get away from that. You can't take away the incentive for people to – if you take away the incentive for people to make money with their money, I think the entire economy gets dysfunctional. It's just it's not an easy problem.
Bruce wants to know, how much property value in the city is exempt due to the STAR program? I have no idea. Do you know, Kent?
I don't.
No idea. No clue.
Yeah.
Great question, though.
And in general, he's wondering how much property value in the city is currently exempt from taxes.
Yeah, I used to know that percentage. I don't know what it is.
It's an increasingly large number. Yeah.
Well, I don't know about increasingly, Mark. I mean, I think most of the exempt property is, you know, has been exempt for a long time. I mean, we do have the Industrial Development Agency that periodically offers tax breaks.
Yeah.
And that's another issue. And it is, I think, in my view, a problem. But I don't think it's an increasing number.
Okay. Kathy says, does your guest have thoughts on how changing properties that used to be long-term rentals to Airbnb short-term rentals has affected the number of properties for sale, the deficit in available rentals, the prices of those available, et cetera? Mark?
It was a fad. It was definitely a fad for a few years. And there were a lot of moms and pas who were buying these homes, turning them into Airbnb, and then the market just became flooded with these things. We've had a lot. We've had any number of men and women who have said, you know what, I just can't do it any longer. A, I'm not making the money, or B, it's just more of a hassle trying to constantly turn these things over. So I do think that it was an issue for a while. I don't see and I don't hear of as many people running out and buying homes for this particular purpose any longer.
But once again, remember, we got two markets here. We're feeding a market for transients and, you know, for example, business visitors, people who come here for recreation purposes. That's a legitimate market. And then we're, you know, have a market for long-term lodging. And,
right.
And they're in conflict. They're in competition, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Charles said, my daughter recently bought a house in Swillburg. Previously, she offered $80,000 over asking on a house in Winton Village, and she came in third. Hmm. She found a house in Swillburg and asked my advice on what to do. And I recalled the best advice my attorney once gave me 40 years ago when I was buying in San Diego in the 1980s. Make the offer that you think the house is worth to you. Don't worry about the other offers. I got the next house I offered on, and same with my daughter. She paid $23,000 over asking for the house in Swillburg, and she moves in on Sunday. Great show.
Great advice, Dad. Seriously, like that's great advice.
I guess I disagree. It depends on how badly you need the house. And what your financial situation
is. I think it's pretty good advice.
I mean, Dad was saying.
But you could be in the market for the next 5 years, too, unless things resolve.
That would be their decision. It wasn't, you know.
Well, I know, but that's the consequence. And if you really need to move into you really need a house for a lot of good reasons.
Then she would have
got the capacity.
More.
Yeah, well, okay.
This show would be boring if we agreed on everything. Ann in Rochester says, we went to see a house this past weekend. It was supposed to have been a flip. It was listed for $200,000. My husband and I and the realtor left the shoddily renovated house covered literally in fleas on our legs.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, fleas.
Oh, gee.
She says, my question is the expert on your show aware of an uptick in scams from people looking to take advantage of the desperately low inventory? In other words, is the insanity of this market attracting more illegitimate so-called flips than usual? And what can people who fall victim to such scenarios do to protect themselves in a time where home buyers are not even able to get an inspection?
I love this question. I don't think that there's been an uptick, but there has been historically any number of people who just do shoddy work. They buy a property, and especially flips are very, very commonly purchased by first-time home buyers. And so what these renovators will do is they'll take hardwood floors. They don't bother sanding them. They don't bother refinishing the hardwood floors. They simply cover them in a shiny polyurethane. And the first time, you know, the 23-year-old, the 26-year-old who doesn't have a trained eye, they see shiny and they think they've been refinished. They're just terrible. We, across the board, encourage our buyers not to purchase properties that have been flipped, because the flipper is really just looking to make money. They're cutting corners very often, and they're just looking at the bottom line.
Yeah, but aren't we getting back to the issue of the inspection? I mean, stopping and not having an inspection, particularly for a first-time home buyer. I mean, I've got a good friend who bought a house that had horrible, horrible roof problems. And, you know, he did have an inspector. The inspector said, gee, you should have a roof inspector because that's an unusual roof. He says, I don't know. I think it's okay. And he paid, I mean, tens of thousands of dollars getting that roof fixed.
Well,
Inspection's critical, really is.
In this market, more likely than not, there are so many people who aren't aware. I'd say for 4 years, 90% of all offers had no inspections associated with them.
Well, that's where I think your suggestion that you drag an engineer along with you, you bring a home inspector in with you in the second view. You know, this is my Uncle George. He's just here to help me out here.
Yeah.
Yeah. And sorry you went through that, but it looks like people are occasionally trying to take advantage of a desperate market.
And I would only say, again, you know, you need to rely on a really, if you don't have the line of defense that you just mentioned, Kent, you've got to have a really, really, really great real estate agent, somebody who can look at and tell you this is a flip. Don't bother. The roof is shot, et cetera.
Experienced agents do half the home inspection on the way through the first
guys, step. I think I, as an agent, could tell you the fleas are a problem. But anyway, hey, one more. Dom says, if the idea of property tax is to tax wealth instead of income, then it seems like it ignores financing. If I just bought a house with a mortgage and I have zero equity, then that doesn't really represent wealth for me. Why not assess property tax based on the owner's equity in the property? Well, wouldn't that be a better way to tax wealth?
Sure.
I don't know how to do it.
Yeah, that's a great question, though.
It's a great question. It's a it's an enormously difficult problem. Anytime you know, at the national level, we start talking about taxing wealth. It's not that I'm opposed to wealth taxes, but darn, they're complicated. You know, you've got a painting on the wall. What's that painting worth? I've friends who are professional musicians who own some darned expensive instruments. Are we going to go into my friend's house and say, well, you've just got that, you've got a $400,000 violin. You need to give me 2% of that every year. I mean, wealth taxes are hard. The property tax, at least the way we do it, it's messy enough as we do it. But I get the guy's point. In theory, there's nothing wrong with that.
I'm going to try to squeeze this in 30 seconds. Ed says, if an increased assessment does not increase taxes necessarily, why is there a need to raise the rent? Is it greed? If it does increase your taxes, why not be required to keep the rent increase to that exact percentage?
Well, the rent is a function of the value of the asset. If you you charge rent because it costs you X dollars to buy the thing, so immediately the assessment goes up, and there's no reason for you to raise the rent. But what if you buy a new property that you want to increase your rental stock, and so you buy another property? Well, that property is going to have the appreciated value. So eventually, you're going to be paying market value for these rental properties, and that's going to affect your mortgage. It's going to affect all the other things.
Once again, Kent Gardner's work in the Rochester Beacon will be posted with our show notes for this broadcast when we post it wherever you find it, whether it's WXXINews.org/connections or in podcast form. Kent is a former chief economist with the Center for Governmental Research. Thank you for being here, Kent.
It's always a pleasure.
Mark Sewick, broker and owner of Elysian Homes by Mark Sewick & Associates. Where do people find you, Mark?
330-8750.
You just gave out a phone number.
Yeah.
I was going for a website.
I'm not going to spell Elysian Homes, nor am I going to spell Sewick.
Fair. Thank you, Mark. Great having you here.
Great seeing you.
More connections coming up.